All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to this Black Friday edition of the Read Rothbard podcast. My name is Daniel, and with me is Robert Johnson. How are you doing, Robert?
Living life, loving it. We're day late, dollar short, but we're still doing it.
Yeah, part of me was thinking that the Thanksgiving special that we did was going to be enough for this week, but then I was like, you know, a lot more things have been happening, and it's Friday, and there's a whole bunch of things going on, and we should do another show.
Yeah, and then I said, okay, I'm ready, and then you said, no, I can't do it, and so now we're recording this on Saturday.
Well, there's that. So I think, appropriately, we should do Black Friday and a movie, so we could do Black Friday Fight Club.
I am willing if you are.
Okay, because I remember we talked about this on one of our previous episodes, and you were saying that you felt like Fight Club was one of your favorite movies of all time. And
top 20.
Now we have.
I don't know if it is now, after having rewatched it recently, but.
Right, because now we've got a different perspective on it.
Yeah. And it, with this new pair of glasses that I wear, it definitely shines a different light on things. There's a lot to unpack, a lot to get into, and can be interpreted many different ways.
All right. Well, before we get into it, I just want to mention that the Black Friday weekend specials for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom is still going on. The price has increased a little bit, and it will continue to do so every day until Cyber Monday, but it's still a significant savings over what you would normally pay pretty much any other time of the year. And if you go through our link, you will be entered to win a Pebble smartwatch. A Pebble Time Steel smartwatch, so like the best of the best of the generation that's currently out there. And then also, if you sign up for the master level, which the master level is a lifetime access versus the other plans, which are just a year. So if you get the lifetime access, not only will you get additional bonuses from Tom himself, which includes courses that he put together for the Ron Paul curriculum, but you will also receive, well, the first five people to take up this offer from us, we'll receive a one-year subscription to the Read It For .me service, which is business books, popular business books, but condensed down into 10 to 12-minute summary descriptions that you get the key points. There's video, there's audio, and there's text. So three different ways to learn. So, you know, if you're a visual learner, if you're an audio learner, you can do whichever one suits you best. So that'll be for free, and that's a $299 normal thing. I've got five of those to give away to anyone who signs up for the master level of Liberty Classroom. So that's my spiel.
Good spiel, Daniel.
So let's talk about Black Friday just a little bit, and then we'll dive into Fight Club. And I feel like these two things kind of go together because people are going to Walmarts across the country at like 3 in the morning and getting into fistfights over a rack of towels or an $89 TV. Or what have you.
Indeed.
And like really getting into it, I saw a meme posted. It's Rocky Balboa, you know, from the Rocky film. And the bottom half is he's holding up a TV and he's like, "Yo, Adrian, I got us a TV on Black Friday." And his face is all beat up and bloody after his fight with Apollo Creed. It's good stuff.
Nice.
But yeah, people just get trampled and fight over just, you know, cheap crap. Now, they're obviously doing this because they think they're going to get a good deal, and they are voluntarily doing this. I just think that when they're resorting to violence, that's where they're crossing some lines.
Absolutely. No, I mean, people are going out in droves because they think they're going to get a good value for their dollars. And as a former victim of Black Friday violence, I feel I'm justified in speaking on this topic, even though I'm justified in speaking on this topic anyway. When you go out and you think you're going to get a good deal, regardless of whether or not you are, you think you're benefiting in this exchange, that's fine. And I don't know, how long is it going to be before people start blaming the retailers for these sorts of violent acts? I don't know, are people already doing that? It seems to me the blame lies solely on the people committing the acts of violence. that's the only way that's consistent with self-ownership. I mean, if you, even if you were to say, you had a store and you sold widgets, and you said for 1 5-minute period, all widgets are a penny. Even if you offered that and there was some mad rush to get all your widgets, I would still lay the blame of the violence on the people actually committing it, because violence, there's no excuse for it. There's no excuse to initiate force against another person, even if you believe you're getting, you're losing out on some opportunity to get some sort of a value on your dollar.
Yeah, and I think that by now this thing's been publicized enough to where there are these mass crowds that show up at these places and fight over things, that people should be well prepared for, you know, they're kind of forewarned about what's going to happen. So they need to be prepared to either, A, shop on Amazon.com using one of our links from ReedRothbard.com, or, you know, be prepared to realize that people are going to be in your face and fighting over things, and maybe plan accordingly to not get yourself involved in that.
Yeah, I didn't go anywhere this Black Friday. I sure as hell didn't. But it is true that these things are happening all around. I would say that the violence is, for a very large country and for the number of consumers that are going out and shopping in droves, I would say that the violence is fairly, I mean, you never want anybody to die for when you're going out shopping. That's just stupid. But any violence will get played up. I would say that. It is a few incidents of it, and they're all deplorable. But on the whole, people are peaceful people. Think of all the times you've shopped voluntarily and peacefully compared to a few instances of violence. The act of shopping is a very low-risk activity. But, yeah, be prepared for anything at all times, because you're an adult human being and you are responsible for your own protection.
Right, situational awareness. You know, we're not blaming the victims here. We're saying, hey, realize that you're walking into an area at a certain time where certain events have happened and will likely happen, and so maybe you're better off either not going there or preparing in some other way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is kind of ridiculous, but so V is for Voluntary has a Facebook page, and I like them. They're libertarian, you know, voluntary society type folks, and they posted a story on their Facebook page or shared one from the Free Thought Project, and it talks about two people were killed during Black Friday, and it had a bunch of links to YouTube videos of people fighting over, you know, towels and little convertible toy cars for kids to drive around in, like big wheels, power wheels.
Mm-hmm.
But they put a hashtag on there that said, ban Black Friday.
What?
Yeah.
How could they be saying that?
So I took a screenshot of that. I underlined voluntary. I underlined ban and wrote in big red letters, WTF? So that'll be posted below the show notes. Because that's just crazy, right?
So to stop people from voluntary exchanging, you need to initiate violence to prevent violence?
Yeah. I posted in Tom Woods' group, and I said, I usually like these guys, but that's a hell of a contradiction.
Yeah, that is so antithetical to what they claim to be about. I mean, if you're saying, let's spread out the value deals, that's a better idea, that's a market force. If retailers, I mean, retailers don't want people to die in their stores either. So if this becomes, you know, a serious, like, PR kind of a problem or any kind of a monetary problem, I think the retailers will voluntarily change their policy to hopefully reduce the amount of conflicts that arrive due to shortages in a particular sale item or whatever.
You know, you'd think so, but this has been going on for at least 5 years as far as I can recall. So it doesn't seem like, well, like you said, it's amplified. Like, any instance will be videoed and posted all over the internet. So maybe it is only a few pockets of things, and we don't see all the preventative measures that retailers do put into place. But just on its face, you know, with how it's presented, it seems as though the retailers are having this occur in their stores, and each year it just continues to happen, and it doesn't seem to be getting addressed.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is getting addressed, but it's just not necessarily the most visible thing.
Right, like when things go well, it's not newsworthy.
Right.
Yeah. So let's hear about your altercation on a Black Friday. I want to hear the story here.
You've heard this story, but the audience hasn't heard it. I actually don't take part in Black Friday. I haven't for decades. But a few years ago, I woke up Black Friday morning, woke into a gunshot in my apartment that had come from, like, the freeway. And all that I have to say is associated with Black Friday is that it happened on Black Friday. I don't know if it was motivated by any other reason. But there was somebody drove by on the freeway and sprayed the apartment building with bullets. And that was fun because I got to deal with cops. And cops got to come in and say, we'd like to search the place. And that's always fun to deal with. And, yeah. So, and then I had to go to work.
Do you think in that situation you could have said no, or because it was technically a crime scene, they would have had some legal bullshit authority to do it anyway?
Probably. I mean, I probably was under some sort of obligation to report it to somebody as a renter. Because it wasn't my property, and I don't know, I wasn't going to go back and read through my contract that I signed with the rental agreement to, if there was such an agreement, I don't know, but I was a victim of a crime, and what do? You call the cops.
Yeah, you don't have a whole lot of other options.
All right.
But when they said they wanted to come in and search the premises, did that rub you the wrong way at all, or were you just like, yeah, this thing happened, and you guys should figure this out? So, yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. I was very reluctant. I mean, I thought, here's the clearly what happened. Here's the place. It came in through the window, and it struck a wall. What else do you need to look for? And to their credit, I don't believe they did look for anything else. They weren't, like, digging through, drawers or anything like that. But just the fact that it's on their little paperwork that they have you sign, saying that, yeah, we came here, you called us to be here, and we're going to investigate this and do whatever, and then uses your consent form that you're allowing us to do this. And by signing this, you also consent to this search. It rankled me a little bit, but I didn't feel super violated in that. I didn't think that they were actually going to go and do that. But the very fact that by accepting their investigation, you're also accepting them to basically do whatever the hell they want in the premises, that's some bullshit.
Yeah, it seems like a very one-sided form there.
Yeah, it's like, if you're going to accept our help with this thing by, investigating this crime, we're also going to take it, whether we want to or whether we're actually going to do it or not, we're also going to basically investigate you for anything you might be doing. We're going to, take this opportunity to look for any other possible crimes that are going on. So anyway, yeah, not cool, but that's the fun of dealing with a monopoly on law enforcement or investigation sort of things. I mean, I suppose you could have gotten a private investigator to track down the person. Wouldn't have been worth it to me, but it might have been worth it to the property owner, I suppose, in a voluntary society.
Well, you broke the window, right? So I'm sure the glassmaker and Paul Krugman were happy.
Right. Yes, it stimulated the economy.
So, speaking of things that happen on Black Friday is just a random coincidence. One of the communist leaders has died on a near capitalist holiday, Black Friday. It's a bit of a delicious irony.
Indeed. Yeah, Fidel Castro, ding dong, the witch is dead. The response has been mixed, mostly from the socialist lefties. They're claiming he was this wonderful dude. Because he's a signal of revolution, but he was actually this oligarch for 57 years. He's this monster. It's interesting, of course, that they have the last, Donald Trump's opinion on pretty much anything. And his opinion is actually seems to be pretty dang good, where he calls him a tyrant and he was a brutal dictator and that he oppressed people for nearly six decades. And then there's all these other lefties that are saying very other things. I don't have examples right in front of me right now, but...
Well, you had that one story you sent me where they opened it with, he shunned living in his family's rich house, and he served the people for 50 years, and he revolutionized the schools and the healthcare and made everything free for everybody.
Yeah, that's going to be the line, I'm sure, from the lefties. That article was a Reuters article saying that he had thrown off his privileged rich life and went on to serve the people and brutally rule them. for 57 years.
Yeah, and he served some 13,000 of them with a round from a gun.
Mm-hmm. And then he served other elites at the expense of far more people. So yeah, it's all horrific. The fact that anybody could like the guy or eulogize him in any kind of positive light is disgusting. There's a wide variety of responses. Here's a Los Angeles Times headline. In Miami, Cubans whoop, dance, and celebrate Castro's death. So, you know, that's how some former Cubans are reacting to it. He's highly associated with Che Guevara, who is a mass murderer himself.
But he looks damn fine on a T-shirt, apparently.
He does. He's got that striking figure that a lot of lefties, and I'm actually guilty of owning one of those shirts at one point in time, too. Basically because, you know, I was uneducated, didn't understand, and I saw him just as this, you know, anti-establishment revolutionary type person and not as a violent, murdering psychopath that brutally seized power and then ran death squads.
Yeah, Castro was no bueno, for sure, and it's interesting to see the difference between the statement from Trump and Obama, and then even further left, Trudeau up in Canada, who was saying, oh, yeah, Castro served the people for nearly six decades and did health care and revolutionized the schools, and my father knew him, and he was a friend, and all this other feel-good emotional garbage for this tyrant who killed at least tens of thousands of people, if not more, and brought a failed economic system to his island where people were suffering. I mean, it's not like things were so good that people weren't fashioning together rafts out of milk crates and milk cartons to try to make it the 90 miles across the open ocean to the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that, yeah, just socialism just destroys. And, yeah, people were desperate to leave it, absolutely.
Yeah, so why don't we start talking about Fight Club, or maybe right before that we could get into Hillary and her recount business, because that's a bit of a Fight Club. The election's not over, apparently, even after she conceded.
Yeah, so has Hillary actually come out and said that she's part of this? She seems to be sort of a cheerleader, but it's clearly obvious that when Jill Stein is looking for election recounts in swing states that Donald Trump won, only Donald Trump won, it's clearly going to be benefiting Hillary Clinton if it finds any kind of malfeasance or fraud or alternate counts or anything like that.
Yeah, I did see a story that said the Clinton campaign will now participate in it to make sure that it's fair to both sides.
Oh, well, there you go. What are the two sides, the Green Party and the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I found that quote to be quite funny, and I posted that in the Tom Woods group with bah-ha-ha-ha-ha with a screenshot of that, as if she's ever not been shady and cheating and trying to scam the system, you know? Like, how's she going to make it fair for both sides?
Yeah, their involvement actually would make it pretty much ensure that it isn't fair, but whatever. I don't know, is there a precedent for some recount and then after you've conceded then say, oh, but I actually won, that sort of thing? I don't know. Has that ever happened? I don't think so.
Well, in 2000 there was the Gore-Bush thing, and Gore had conceded, I think, or did he not concede yet?
See, I don't remember at all. I remember that the Supreme Court essentially gave the presidency to Bush because the recount in Florida was still happening and still happening and still happening, and they couldn't come to a number. And at one point, the Supreme Court just kind of stepped in and said, okay, it's over. We're calling it for Bush because, you know, it's impossible to have power. We must have a figurehead at the top of this pyramid, and without it, you know, chaos and destruction and murder and anarchy, and it's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, I really wish we could live in a world where it didn't matter who was president and nobody cared.
Oh, yeah, well, nobody cared. That would be great. I mean, I could argue that it doesn't matter, that the machine continues regardless of what figurehead is at the top steering the wheel. You know, it's like one of those McDonaldland toy steering wheels that don't actually, you know, do anything. But the presidential policies do actually kill people, and they do wield some power that does actually affect lots of lives.
Yeah, but the choices that we're given, there's really no significant difference between them. Like many of Trump's positions are very, very similar to Bernie's positions, which are very, very similar to Hillary's positions. Like, they're all essentially the same thing, except on a few minor things that really don't matter all that much. And
yeah, Alex Jones calls those football issues. He says that they're all the same on all the anti-people measures. They all agree on all those. But when it comes to a few football issues, they disagree, like on abortion or Planned Parenthood or whatever. Immigration, they have slight differently opinions or whatever. They'll make a show of their differences when in fact they're actually very similar.
Yeah. In fact, I saw some video where it was contrasting Trump's statements that everyone was all upset about immigration and the wall and all these things. And they play back clips from Clinton from 10, 15, 20 years ago where she says essentially the same thing, or Bill Clinton does. They have clips of both of them. And they're essentially saying the exact same thing, only Trump now gets in trouble for them, whereas the Clintons get a pass. But that just highlights how they're not any different at all.
Mm-hmm.
Another funny thing that I see when all these leftists are celebrating Castro as such a great person, it's hilarious because he actually did put people into camps, in re-education camps. They're all worried about Trump, where they're celebrating some guy who actually did it, just like they celebrate FDR and just like they celebrate Lincoln. You know, they celebrate these monsters who did like horrendous stuff. Like almost as bad as Hitler type stuff, and they're their heroes, and they're all worried about Trump, who hasn't even said he's going to do any of that crap. Like, it's all fear mongering from the left echo chamber, trying to drum up, you know, some emotional response to get the election swung in Hillary's favor leading up to it, and then they all drank their own Kool-Aid, and now they're all freaking out about it, and they think he's the second coming of, you know, Hitler or Satan himself.
Yep.
Like, yeah, they were telling their kids nightmare stories about Trump. And their kids are crying about it. Like, remember on election night, we were like, now here's all the stuff talking about how I'm going to tell my kids in the morning.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have told them the bullshit to begin with, moron.
Yeah, or how about tell them that you don't necessarily respect somebody just because they're president. You know, there's a whole line of, you know, respect the office and that kind of bullshit. Respect the rank or respect whatever. No. I don't respect any person that claims to be an authority figure over me, because all authority is a threat. Do this or else. So
those are fighting words, Jonathan.
Those are absolutely. What is respectful needs to be respected about that? Why would you respect some tyrant? I mean, you just replace president with mafia don. And why does a mafia don deserve my respect? They do almost exactly the same thing. They run protection rackets. They steal, thieve. I mean, the only thing difference is that the mafia is kind of has to use violence to police themselves because they're prevented from using the court system, and they fill market needs. Where actually they use a lot of voluntary services, where the government doesn't. In fact, I'd say the mafia might be better.
Well, they don't have a monopoly on the violence. They're just an alternate competing agency that isn't sanctioned by the monopoly agency.
Right, and their violence isn't even seen as good or legal. When they commit violence, it's seen as deplorable, as it should be. But when the state commits violence, it's seen, well, it's necessary and good because it's the government.
Yeah.
So
So there's all that stuff. So Castro and Clinton, peas in a pod.
Yeah. They're disgusting and gross. And it's too bad he didn't see the light before he died. But, you know, he's a piece of garbage. And he's not going to get my respect, nor will Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or any of these other monsters. Even if Donald Trump's crimes are mostly ahead of him.
Yeah, but they will happen.
Oh, undoubtedly.
I did see a meme on Anarchy Ball from that old saying, the only good communist is a dead communist. So they said, Castro is finally a good communist.
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, speaking of fighting words, let's talk about Fight Club.
The Club of Fighting. Okay, let's get into this.
What's the first rule?
We're talking about it. We're breaking the rules.
We are breaking the rules. We are breaking both first and second rule of Fight Club.
That's right. When was the last time you saw this movie, Daniel?
I have been attempting to watch it over the course of a few days. I probably made it 1.5 hours into a 2-hour and 20-minute movie.
Oh, you've seen most of it then. Okay. So you can talk with some ability to most of my notes. So, in 1999, David Fincher adapted let me try and pronounce this word again, Chuck Palahniuk novel. It was his first book. and he never thought it would actually be published, but it did, and then it got turned into a movie to his further surprise. And see here, David Fincher directs it, Edward Norton stars, Brad Pitt, Helena Bonham Carter stars, Meatloaf stars, and Jared Leto's in it too, with music by the Duff Brothers. And, you know, this is like, I think, one of the first, or one of the last, I guess you could say, the last CDs, soundtracks that I obtained. I was a big Duff Brothers fan at the time, because these were the guys that produced the Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique, which is a classic rap album. And I'm a big fan of that album. So I followed their work on the Fight Club movie. So, Fight Club, what's it about? It's the story of a man going insane. And he brings others along on this crazy ride and becomes this sort of like cult figurehead person. Starts off, he's like an insomniac. And I don't know if the movie tries to claim that insomnia will drive you crazy, and that's why he's crazy. Or if he's just crazy, he doesn't really get into the why of it. It just is, and it's happening. The movie is kind of famously anti-consumerist, which is a good reason to talk about this movie on Black Friday.
Not to mention the fighting.
And the fighting. I wouldn't say that we're anti-consumerist. There's a fair amount of, like, philosophizing. Like, you're not your bank account. You are not your IKEA couch. You're not, you know, what you've accumulated in life. You're more than that. You can cast off these consumer goods. These things that you own end up owning you, that sort of philosophy. And those sort of things I can appreciate because I'm sort of a minimalist. I don't necessarily see the need to accumulate a whole lot of things. But from a value standpoint, I mean, what is your decision to value a couch over somebody else's decision to not value a couch? I mean, they're both opinions are equally valid.
Yeah, it's individual preferences. I'd almost say that the original writer got a lot of influence from John Kenneth Galbraith.
Oh, yeah? Who's that?
He's one of those economists who was all against advertising. So he would say that advertising is merely a tool used to make you want things that you don't actually need.
That guy. So you're just a slave to advertising?
Yeah, he's terrible.
You can't decide for yourself whether you want a thing. When you see an ad for a Coca-Cola, you must go out and buy a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and if there weren't ads for things, you'd just magically know about them and know how to get them or know what they are or know that they would potentially solve a problem you have if there was no advertising.
Right. Okay, so, yeah, that sounds about right then. He probably did take some of that into his influence. Although I will say, on the record, and I've mentioned this to you before, but this is a fairly arty movie, and I think it's open to interpretation a lot because a lot of the ideas kind of conflict with each other, and it's not clear if the author had, like, a message at all, or it could be taken any number of ways. Anyway, we'll get into it. So the movie starts out, and we've got a very unhappy insomniac who works for a car company where he is a recall evaluator. So if there are a bunch of accidents, for any particular defect in a car, he'll go and he'll run the numbers on whether or not they should do a recall or not. He'll like evaluate the anticipated number of claims and lawsuits, and he'll balance it out and decide whether or not to do it or not. So he travels a lot for his job, and he's very unhappy with his travel. And he first kind of meets, I guess you could say, this Tyler Durden character on an airplane. And spoiler alert, we realize that he is a made-up character fairly early on, although the main character doesn't realize it until way later. But maybe it's because I already knew that. I don't remember my initial viewing, whether I realized it immediately or not. But there are several frames in the movie early on where you see flashes of Tyler Durden. And there's even a scene where the main character is describing who Tyler Durden is, and he says that he works as a projectionist in a movie theater, where he splices in one frame of porno into like a kid's movie, and then he has the line, "Nice big cock." So it's kind of telegraphing that you're going to see splices of this. I don't know. It's fun. So anyway, then his apartment explodes. And it's not clear whether he collects the insurance money on that. But it is clear later on that he did it himself, that he set a kind of a bomb to explode. Even if it would take place, it took a long time. So it only explodes when he finally gets back to his apartment. Like he's at the bottom of the building and he sees the explosion. And then later on, it's determined that he did it himself. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Daniel. He's in an apartment building. It's not clear whether he owns the condo or if he rents, but he blows up all his own stuff and claims to be like a victim.
Hey, go back about 10 seconds and start your statement over again. I think it cut out.
Okay. So he was down at the bottom of his floor of his apartment, and the apartment explodes, and it's determined that he's later determined in the movie that he did it. So it's not clear in the movie whether he is a renter or an owner. Probably a renter, but we don't know. He doesn't go through the act of, like, selling the place. But there is an insurance, like a police guy investigating the arson. I mean, if you own a piece of property, you have the right to destroy it, and nobody else can say anything about it. But if you explode, obviously, somebody else's property, even if you're also exploding your own stuff in the process, obviously that's an act of arson. So he's right off the bat. The movie kind of portrays him as like the main character hero, and you're supposed to kind of identify with him. But throughout the movie, he's doing all these horrible things, and it's really hard for him to be a sort of a likable character. Maybe he was back when I first watched it, but not this second time. It just kept going. It kept getting worse and worse and worse. Anyway, so he goes into the spiel of after his apartment is exploded, he calls up Tyler Durden, who lives in this dilapidated old house on Soap Street, where he runs the Soap Street paper company, or no, soap company. And it's this real shithole, like old mansion, that is just falling down and leaks, and the electricity goes out when it rains, and the refrigerator doesn't work, and all this crap. It's really terrible. But he seems to be happier. He's rejecting like all these material possessions and that sort of thing. Then Tyler, they go and steal fat from this dumpster at this liposuction place, and seems to be, even though it was behind a fence, a razor wire fence, and they did have to hide from this like security guard guy. I don't really have a problem with dumpster diving. Do you have a problem with dumpster diving? Do you think it violates the NAP, Daniel?
I think if it's on the side of the street, no problem. But if it's within a private area that's got fence and gate, then yeah.
Okay, so you think it's theft then? They're stealing this garbage fat?
Yeah, but only because of the location of where it was.
Okay.
Like, it was something they had intended to throw away, get rid of, and that being the case, you know, it's clear that they were giving up title to it, but mm-hmm. by them entering the premises, they violate the private property.
Let me back up. There's a big part of the movie early on where he goes to these, he's very unhappy, and so he gets suggested by, I forget who, to go to one of these support groups. Like, you think you're sad, go to these guys with testicle cancer, sad. And so he does, and he feels way better. He starts to sleep, and he keeps going to all these groups, these support groups for all these different diseases, which he does not have. It's never shown that he actually gets up and talks and claims to have these diseases, but he does go to these events.
He does say that because he goes there and doesn't say anything, people assume the worst, and so then they hug him and give him comfort.
Right. Do you have any kind of issue with this? Do you think it's an issue of fraud, or if he's just lending his support to other people?
I think it's a lie of omission. By him being there, he's sort of implicitly indicating that he has such an issue, and by withholding the fact that he does not, then yeah, I think it's a bit of a lie.
Okay, what about when Helena Bonham Carter goes to the testicle cancer group?
Same deal.
How is that a same deal? How is that a lie of omission for a woman to go to a testicle cancer place? Clearly she doesn't have testicle cancer.
Well, maybe this film was quite prescient, and she was a transgender individual.
Okay, so she's lying by not claiming to be a trans person at this testicle place. Okay, so fast forward back to after they steal fat from a dumpster and they're making soap, and they're in the kitchen of this dilapidated house. And at the time, it's not clear, it hasn't been stated yet that Tyler Durden and the main character are one and the same person yet. At the time, Tyler Durden grabs the main character's hand and says, only after we lose everything are we free to do anything. Only after we've lost everything are we free to do anything. And he takes, what is it, some sort of a chemical and pours it on his hand.
Lye.
Okay, so he takes lye, pours it on his hand, and he's, like, holding it. And Edward Norton is, like, you know, in massive amount of pain. And but Durden is like, no, stay with it. This is you. This is the greatest moment of your life. You'll never – everything else after this will just be nothing compared to this. This is the greatest thing ever. What do you think of the scene?
Well, at the time, not knowing that he was one and the same person,
yeah,
I thought that it was – sort of an initiation thing, sort of similar to how when the people who are recruiting come to the house and they tell them to go away and keep yelling at them and say, we're going to call the police if you stay here. But if they stay the 3 days, then they're initiated, they can come in and join the little cult.
Yeah.
I think that was the initial cult initiation.
Okay. Did you see it as an act of violence? Did you see it as a violation of the NAP?
Now I do, but when I first saw the film, probably not. I mean, it certainly seemed
now,
fucked up. I wouldn't want it to happen to me.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, once you know that they're one and the same person, then you can't get upset for somebody pouring lye on their own hand.
Yeah, you can just say, that was a stupid idea. I wouldn't do that.
Right. Okay. Then after that, they start recruiting people, like you said. They start recruiting all these people, and it's very much a cult. And Tyler Durden is shouting all these kind of, I don't know, what would you call them? Like, insults, kind of like dehumanizing people.
Yeah, he said if they're young, tell them they're too young. If they're old, tell them they're too old. If they're fat, tell them they're too fat. And just yell at them for 3 days. Just try to make them go away.
Right. Let's see here. Okay.
Well, while you're looking that up, I was a little bit confused even watching it now with the Helena Bonham Carter character.
Yeah.
Like, I understand, you know, Durden tells Edward Norton, like, hey, don't ever talk to her about me. And now it's clear, you know, it's because they're the same person.
Right.
But I'm a little bit confused. Like, is she an actual person and she's trying to have a relationship with Ed Norton? And sometimes he's Tyler Durden and fucking her brains out. And other times he's Ed Norton and he's all, like, antagonized by her and telling her to get the hell out of there. Like, is she a real person? Or is this a thing in their mind?
No. I read it exactly how you just said it. She's a real person that is having a relationship with somebody with split personality disorder. Or I don't even know if you call it split personality disorder. I mean, he not only has split personality, but he also imagines the other personality. I think when you're subject to split personality, you're not aware necessarily of the other personalities. But he's aware, and he's the other person. Anyway, he's an insane person, and she's actively having a relationship with him. And she likes the Tyler Durden character. And, yeah, not so much the Edward Norton character.
But she's also
Edward Norton.
She's also a bit of a crazy person.
Definitely. She's not super – she has that line, I've been fucked like that since grade school. I mean,
yeah.
She's, you know, she's kind of messed up. So at this time, they're kind of getting Fight Club started. And they initially have a fight outside of the bar when he first calls him. And it's later determined that, you know, he's just fighting, punching himself. But Fight Club kind of starts taking off, and they get more and more people. And there's a scene where they're in Lou's basement. And Lou comes down, and it's free to all to join this group. It's a club. It's free to join. There's no, like, membership dues or anything like that. And Lou comes down, and he sees all these people down in his basement. And he's like, what is this? What the hell are you people doing here? Get out of here. You're not welcome. Or he's like, you know, you're making money. I need a cut of this. You know, he's a businessman. He's got all these people in his basement. He wants to get something out of it. And Pritt's like, well, there's no money. It's free. There's no money to be had. And he's like, well, then you need to leave. And he's like, yeah, but we, and then Pitt's like, no, we really like this place. Please let us stay, please. And I believe Lou goes up to Pitt and he starts beating him up. And Pitt's like, no, I don't really get it. Keep hitting me. And Lou realizes he's dealing with, like, a crazy person. and he kind of consents after Pitt like spits blood all over his face. What did you think of the scene? You saw the scene, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, so Lou's the owner of the tavern, and he goes down there thinking that they're making money, and he either wants them to cut it out and stop using his place or give him a cut of the money. And
right.
He's a bit of an enforcer, and he's got one of his thugs with him who's got a gun, and he proceeds to beat up Tyler Durden. And he's like, do you understand what I'm saying? Do you get it? And Tyler's like, I don't get it yet, or I don't get it. And then he goes, okay, fine. No, wait, I forgot. And, you know, proceeds to let Lou beat the shit out of him. Until
right.
Lou finally relents. And I think you're right. Yeah, realizes that he is a crazy person and just lets him continue. Because Durden's like, oh, you should join our club, man. You should do this.
Yeah.
But I don't pretend to understand the whole movie, actually. I mean, you're right. It is a bit of an art piece. So I don't know what that was intended to say. Though, from my perspective now, I'm like, yeah, property rights. Lou had every right to go down there and say, hey, I want this to cease, you know?
Right, and when Pitt refuses to leave, does he have the right to initiate force against him? What do you think?
I think it could have been a little more tactful, but he did seem a little mafioso, so I guess maybe that's how he would have done it. I mean, who am I to say how someone else should handle an intrusion on their own property?
Yeah.
It's not up to me. I wouldn't do it that way,
right.
But I'm not a mafioso mob boss tavern owner.
Right. So, okay. What do you think of him consenting to allow the fight club after he realizes he's dealing with a crazy person who just spit up blood all over his face, who says, you don't know where I've been, Lou. Do you think that's voluntary consent to allow the fight club, or do you think he was coerced into that?
Well, maybe grossed out into. I don't know if it's coercion. I think it was just putting it over the top of, yes, I am dealing with an actual crazy person. So if I don't know. I think he does consent because he realizes that it's easier to just let it happen than to fight it. And so maybe that's still a violation, but he sort of does choose that path. I don't know. It's a little murky. It's a gray area for me.
Yeah, it's a little murky for me too. There's fault on both sides. Okay, immediately after that, Tyler Durden gives everybody in Fight Club homework. And I had a big issue with this. He says that everybody needs to start a fight with a stranger. And you have to lose that fight. So then starts this montage of all these Fight Club people just being absolute assholes and going around and pushing people and like spraying water on them and just doing everything you can to start a fight. So from Pitt's angle or Tyler Durden's angle, I see this as bad advice because he's not threatening anybody that they have to do this. This is a voluntary club. So it's on each individual person to go out and attack people or not. It's interesting that their job is to lose the fight, but at the end of the day, they are initiating violence against peaceful people.
Yeah, it's not the NAP isn't lose the fight that you initiated. No, it's the initiation of force that's wrong.
Right.
Whether they lose or not is irrelevant.
Right. So, yeah, I had a big problem with that scene. So that kind of further reduced my seeing the Tyler Durden character as any kind of a sympathetic, you know, protagonist. I think that is kind of an interesting movie in that sense, in that you kind of start to see the devolution of the character, where he starts off as kind of this kind of liberating character of this person who feels trapped in this kind of consumer culture, and he wants to reject all that and live in this shithole and cast aside all these things, all these societal conventions. And then it kind of devolves into this person that's, I don't know, kind of this, yeah, like cult-type inciting violence type of person. Anyway, so for me, the Tyler Durden, so he kind of turns into this villain character. And it accurately portrays this insanity of this character, the Edward Norton person, the splitting of his personality, the splitting of his psyche. Okay, so then the next scene that I have to talk about is the scene where Edward Norton, he wants to have Fight Club like all the time, and he wants his car company to subsidize it. So he goes in and he threatens his boss with paying him essentially to leave because he'll be like very difficult or he knows some dirt on people. And so the boss is like, what, are you threatening me? And then the Edward Norton character starts beating himself up, and he makes it look like the boss has been beating him up. And then security comes in. and sees this scene where Edward Norton's all beaten up and bloody, and then he's like at the mercy of the boss, and he's saying, please don't hit me anymore. Obviously some serious fraud going on by Edward Norton character. But we as an audience were supposed to kind of like cheer it because the boss is like some bad corporate dude, even though that's never established. Just that he has certain standards of behavior and conduct at the workplace, which Edward Norton continually violates. But he's supposedly seen as the villain character. So we're supposed to, as an audience, kind of get behind the Edward Norton character when he does this. What do you think of the scene, Daniel?
Well, I think this one is a prime example of a government intervention gone awry.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
So Norton goes into the boss as he's progressively gotten more and more office space on him. You know, more and more each time he goes to work, he's dressing less and less like he is supposed to be at work, and he's doing less and less of the actual work.
Right.
Not that he's gutting fish on the copier or anything like that, but he is making Fight Club posters on the copier. And actually, this is a scene a little bit earlier where the boss finds one of these printouts on the copier and starts to question Norton about it. And he's like, this might be someone very close to you, someone very dangerous, who might come in here with an AR-15, MC-10, it was some gun he describes, and shoot everybody here in a very menacing way.
Boy, yeah, and then he goes, or maybe you shouldn't just bring every piece of shit you find to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I think that alone would have been enough in today's environment to get him fired.
I would think so.
In fact, they should be able to fire anyone for any reason whatsoever, or no reason at all. Like, if they want to, so be it.
Yeah, it's a completely voluntary relationship.
Yes. But back to the scene that you're talking about, the government intervention that I'm mentioning is that Norton has dirt in that the company has a certain failure rate, and that this is perfectly known to the government because they're within that mandate of whatever certain number of failures are permissible. But
for any particular thing? Any particular...
Yeah, it's like failure on brake lines, he mentions, or something that ignites in the passenger compartment and burns the people alive. That's another certain thing that's been happening. And apparently, and this is a bit of reading into it, but apparently there's a threshold over which that's permissible per the government regulations. So if it only happens X number of times per 1,000 units, it's okay.
But one more, and then all of a sudden it's a problem.
Right, and his threat to the boss is not that he's going to report it to the government. It's that he's going to report it to the media.
Oh, okay.
So that's an intervention.
That's
an intervention that the government has made something actually demonstrably worse, in that if it were a free market situation, then in all likelihood, every instance would be made aware, you know, to anyone who wished to know about it, and that companies would compete on not only price and quality, but also on minimizing the number of malfunctions that cause death and incineration.
Right, as opposed to somebody saying, it's okay for you to have X number.
Right, like there's some FDA thing that says a certain number of parts per million of rat feces is okay in your cereal.
Right.
You know, most of the time there's none.
Only 1-0.
Right, but yeah, there's certain thresholds, right, and that's a government thing. And I think that in the absence of government, the threshold would be a lot lower.
Yes. But now, that was probably not the intention of the scene, but that is, into it, but yeah. What do you think of, the actual act of fraud from the protagonist?
Well, I'm a little torn on it.
Really?
Like, the beating himself up thing is certainly fraudulent, but he has certain information that he's offering a service to the boss to say, hey...
But it's a coercive threat, though. Hey, do X or else I will do X.
No, it's a negotiation. There's no threat of violence in that, hey, pay me my salary to keep quiet, or I'll go to the media with damning information about your company.
Is that actually what happened in the scene?
That was what I read into it. He went to the boss saying, hey, pay me my salary to keep quiet, or I'll tell the media about this, this, and this.
But then he was like, are you crazy? Get out of here. I don't care about that. And then he started beating himself up, and then that's how he got his salary.
Right, that part's certainly fraudulent, yes.
Okay.
By beating himself up and making it appear as if the other guy beat him up, which sort of put him in a position to where he had to agree to his previous demand. So it was a bit of a... He was the initiation of force against himself.
Well, plus he also trashed the guy's office. He destroyed a bunch of property.
Yes. And it was to gain leverage in his negotiation efforts, fraudulently.
Yeah.
So I think if he had stopped at, hey, if you don't agree to the terms of pay me my salary to keep quiet, I will tell the media about this. You know, take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, to negotiate further. But to get into the fraudulent area, that was overstepping the bounds.
Okay, I'm with you on that. Sounds good. Okay, then, let's see. It's mentioned that, what do you think of his jobs that he was doing? Like, when he was in the restaurant, he would pee in the soup, which is clearly, I think, an act of aggression. And then also as a projectionist, when he would splice in porn, what do you think about that? People are going to the theater voluntarily, but they're expecting a certain thing.
Yeah, it's certainly not something that they paid for. I want to draw a parallel to when Mike Pence went to go see the Hamilton theater show on Broadway.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, and at the end, the cast called him out and made some political speech to him about inclusiveness and racial this and all this other stuff.
Right.
And I read that as a violation of the terms of his agreement to be there. Like, he bought a ticket to see the show, not to be berated.
Yeah, I would think most patrons go to entertainment to be entertained, not to be talked to or talked down to or eulogized at or whatever.
Yeah, and the cast are in the employee or are in the employ of the owner of the theater in some way, you know, through whatever company and contracts and all that. So I think it was up to the employee, the owner of the theater, who offered the ticket, the voluntary contract with the patron, to make sure that his company, his employees, the dance troupe or whatever the hell they are, know that that's inappropriate.
I would say so, although I would say that it did happen after the show, and he is free to leave at any time. But you're right. He did purchase the ticket price for a certain amount of entertainment and with certain expectations, although what exactly those expectations are, I couldn't say.
Yeah, and I don't know when this happened. I imagine at the closing, you know, like everyone's bowing at the end and the audience is still there and applauding them.
Probably something like
that. So it's a bit difficult once you're called out to walk away from that. And if you were to walk away from it, I'm sure there would be consequences to that as well. I mean, imagine the news stories.
Well,
people start calling out Pence and he walks away. It would be worse than... Did he walk out?
Yeah, he was walking. He either was walking out or he had walked out. I don't know if he was walking out exactly when they started talking or after they were finished talking, but I think, as I recall in the story, he heard it from either like the adjacent hallway. Like, he could still hear them talking as he was walking out. I don't know if he started walking out when they first started talking. I don't know exactly all that, but I do recall something along those lines.
All right, that just shows my ignorance of the situation. I mean, that's what I get for just reading the headlines, you know, which is a huge problem.
Well, yeah, but there's so many headlines, to be in your defense. If you were to spend how much time it would take to read all the news articles that we talk about, if you were to...
Yeah. Well, with you telling me that, I can only imagine that the headlines would have been far worse if it could be demonstrably shown that they started talking to him and then he walked away.
Yeah, I think they probably had it, you know, probably before the show they get word that he's there. And so then they quickly write up, or that he's going to be there. So they quickly write up a little speech to do after the show. And probably when the show was over, he probably got up and started leaving, and then they were like, well, we're still going to do it. Probably what happened, but I don't exactly know.
Yeah, because just imagine if he's still sitting there, they're doing the final curtain call, bow, whatever, and then they start addressing him, and then he walks up middle of it and leaves. Mm-hmm. The stories would be so different. The headlines would be vastly different.
Probably. Yeah, he was probably already on his way out. And I know their speech got like big cheers from the liberal New York crowd.
Of course.
As you can imagine. Okay, getting back to the Club of Fighting.
At Walmart, the Friday Black Friday version or the movie, Tyler Durden version?
The documentary version. The next scene that I want to talk about is they're really getting into the Project Mayhem. There's a montage where all the fight clubbers go around and they vandalize and they sabotage. There's a scene where they got like Tyler Durden has like a golf club and he's hitting cars, smashing cars, and they like set up a one of those tire strips against the car and they drive it over the tire strips, destroying the tires. And then they have like birds shitting all over cars and things like that. It's all very terrible. These are all taken. These are the heroes, the heroes of the show. It was really hard to get behind. I didn't understand the political or the whatever message they were trying to get across. But what is the What is their message that they're trying to get across here?
It seemed to be just anti-consumerism, just go along in your existence without being aware that there's this greater nirvana of knowing or something, you know?
Yeah, get rid of all your possessions, so we're going to destroy your possessions for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's clearly a violation of the NAP, like, across the board. This Project Mayhem is a terrible thing. It's a very bad light of anarchy, you know, destruction of property. It's the red and black type.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, you shouldn't own this, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so the next scene, because that one was pretty straightforward. This next scene is all, I mean, it gets pretty bad from here on out, but we'll still talk about it. The next scene is Tyler Durden pulls a gun out of a backpack as the two characters are walking some direction, like home or something like that, after they've done vandalizing all these cars. And he pulls out a gun, he goes into a convenience store. And then we get the scene of Tyler Durden with the gun to the head of the convenience store clerk out behind the convenience store. And he gets the guy to give him his license. And he's like calling this guy, you know, what did you want to be with your life? What are you doing here as a convenience store? You wanted to be a veterinarian. And he's got this guy, gun to the guy's head, and he says that, you know, if I forget the amount of time he gives him, but he's like, in 2 weeks, if you haven't gotten on the road to becoming a veterinarian, I'm going to come and find you and kill you. And his rationale for doing this horrific act of violence, he says afterwards, he goes, and to be fair, the Edward Norton character's against it the whole time. So he's still fighting in his own mind. He starts to question his split personality, because he's like, what are you doing? This is crazy. Why do you have a gun? Why are you pointing it at this guy? And the Tyler Durden character, or the Tyler Durden half of his psyche, says, think about tomorrow. He's going to wake up, and it's going to be the greatest day of his life. His oatmeal is going to taste better than ever. We'll have no amazing – it'll be the most amazing breakfast in the world. He totally envies this character that he just attacked. What do you think of this scene, Dan? It kind of goes along the lines of the lie on the hand thing, where he's justifying this violence to kind of shock people out of their complacence with their life, I guess.
Yeah, this is a tough thing. I mean, it's clearly a violation. He threatens him with his... I mean, it's later revealed that the gun was empty, but anyone who knows anything about firearms, you always treat any firearm as if it's loaded, and you don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. And, of course, the recipient of said gun pointed at them was not aware that it was empty.
Correct.
So clearly a threat, a mortal threat. And this ex post facto justification of, well, now he's going to appreciate his life even better. His oatmeal is going to taste the best it ever tasted.
Yeah.
Clearly a bullshit justification. And if you can justify that type of behavior, you can use it for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, well, this is for the greater good. This was to achieve this great end. I committed this great evil to achieve this great end, which
yeah,
every time in history has ever
right,
done.
It's very Machiavellian ex post facto justification. Yeah, all the greatest horrors in history have all been for some great cause.
Yeah, so clearly this is terrible. I mean, yeah, the end result is the guy didn't get shot, and his oatmeal probably did taste better the next day, but still clearly a violation of the NAP, should not have happened. I disavow it. I disavow it completely.
Me too. I think absolutely. Regardless of the outcome, the act itself is so disgusting, you cannot justify it. Okay, so then they get home, and there's this swarm of people that they've recruited. It's this whole army, essentially, of this Project Mayhem cult members. And Tyler Durden starts kind of, I don't know, what would you say? He's shouting, kind of like, I don't know, he's like this cult figurehead, and he starts kind of just shouting, okay, in the house. Like, you are not your bank account, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you're worthless.
You're not a beautiful snowflake. You're worthless. Yeah, exactly. Sacrifice yourself for the greater good. Very communistic, collectivist talk. You're nothing. The cause is everything. The state is everything. He doesn't say state, but that's essentially what it is. Sacrifice yourself for the greater good, the collective. Very anti-human, anti-individualist talking. I'm completely against it at that point. And the Edward Norton character is kind of like a fly on the wall, looking it all happen, where the Tyler Durden character is like the messiah figure.
Well, then the news report shows that building blow up with a smiley face, And Norton's like, what have you guys done? What is this? And all the people look at him like a little bit perplexed, and then they laugh because they're like, well, you're the dude who told us to do this.
Yes. And then they think it's like a test. Every time he questions them, they think it's like some sort of test because the big, you know, the rule is that you can't question the Project Mayhem. You can't question anything that they do.
Right.
So it's very cult-like in that, yeah, whatever Durden says is gospel, and it's not your position as a human being to question anything or to object or to have any kind of conscience about what you're doing, and that you're just some sort of nothing. You don't even exist. You're just there to serve the cause. Then after the smile, do you have anything to say on that?
Yeah, so this goes back to when we first started talking about Project Mayhem and even part of this portion of the discussion, in that how responsible, because you had said that it was just bad advice that Durden had given them to go out and smash cars and reverse the spikes on a parking garage, you know, driveway.
Well, he actually takes part. He does
right.
it himself. So
but you said it was bad advice, essentially.
Well,
for the things that other people did that he did not do.
Correct. He is encouraging other people to do terrible things, but it is ultimately on themselves whether they're going to do it or not.
So I'm going to throw a hypothetical
out. It's a voluntary club.
Yes, it's voluntary, but at some point, he's doing tactics like the loudspeaker indoctrination information, like the prison camp, like we're your friends, you are not your couch, you're not a unique snowflake. Like these are things to break down the individual.
True.
To do the greater good, so they sort of lose their ability to differentiate and make their own conscious individual choices.
But they still own themselves, and it's still
yeah,
on
but
themselves
don't you,
whether they do something or not.
Do you deny that brainwashing exists?
No. I do not deny that.
So
but
how does that
you,
play into your understanding
you
of individuals?
If you're under a brainwashing, then you are no longer responsible for your own actions?
I think that's the point of brainwashing, isn't it?
So would you then argue that the indoctrination and the brainwashing that occurs in the nation's schools makes that people that go out and aggress against others and perpetuate the system and vote and that sort of thing are not responsible for their own actions for doing that?
No, you son of a bitch. That's a terrible question and a great question. Well, let's dial it down to the Fight Club movie.
You're making the argument. If you're making that argument, you got to apply it universally.
Right, but let's first understand it in this microcosm.
Okay.
So you said earlier that Project Mayhem, the people going out and doing these things, are essentially following bad advice. But he's also doing the cult-like mind control brainwashing action to where he's breaking down their ability to make conscious individual choices. Now, I don't know the psychology behind it, whether it's an actual thing, but
I wouldn't say that he's hypnotizing anybody, but he is definitely espousing some sort of an ideology.
Right. So at what point are they no longer responsible for their actions? Is it never? Like, as much brainwashing as ever, like, if you're to maximum brainwashing, like, we're maximum freedom, if someone has been applied maximum brainwashing, are they solely responsible for whatever they do?
I would have to get into the science of it. From what I understand of, like, hypnotism, all it does is reduce your inhibitions to do a thing. You would never actually – if you would not do a thing normally, you would still not do a thing. Like, even under hypnotism, you couldn't get a guy to shoot somebody if they wouldn't normally otherwise do it, from what I understand.
So it's like getting them really, really drunk?
Yeah, you're taking away your inhibitions. As far as indoctrination goes, it's obviously a very powerful tool. You can get people to do all kinds of things, like support a violent, horrific system like the government, obviously, and think it's a good thing. But at what point are you no longer owning yourself and your own actions? I think you have to establish you have to put out a whole ton of evidence before you say that this person is no longer in control of their own actions. They're no longer owning themselves.
Do you think that Mayhem, Project Mayhem, the individuals doing it, granted it's a movie, but do you think that they were fully aware of their conscious decisions and they were still doing it? Or do you think that Durden, as the director of said actions, is certainly responsible?
Oh, well, he also takes place. He takes part. I mean, if he was just like some guy on the telephone giving advice to somebody and not actually doing anything himself, that's different. But he actually does absolutely physically take part in all these things that Project Mayhem does. So I think they're all equally responsible.
Okay.
if you want to, you think you would apply more blame or like a greater, harsher punishment to the insane person, to the Edward Norton character, than to one of the followers? Is that what you're saying? Even though they do the same thing?
Well, it's tough because then you're also getting into like the Hitlers of the world or the other dictator types like Castro,
mm-hmm.
Who are sending out orders telling people to do terrible things, and the people do the terrible things, but because they believe in the system or the authority.
But that's totally different. You're talking about a voluntary system versus a coercive situation. Once you join like the government, like you're in the military, you have to follow orders or else you will be locked in a cage or, in a lot of cases, murdered. But in Project Mayhem, you can come and go as you please. You can either voluntarily choose to take part in whatever they're doing, or you can leave. Never in the movie does Durden put a gun to anybody's head and say you have to do a thing.
Except for the shop clerk,
you're right.
You have to go back to veterinary school.
Right. But none of the members of Project Mayhem are ever threatened or coerced into doing what they do, as far as I understand it.
They're only threatened with, you need to leave now, because you're not worthy of being one of us or whatever. Like when they're initiating.
Right, like disassociation.
Yeah.
Like we don't want to associate with you. You need
all right,
to leave
so back to your macro question then, where you say that if the dictator tells the government employee, the army person, to do something, that's no longer a voluntary relationship. Well, what about the mandatory school attendance laws and the government programs to, you know, keep people in schools and go to schools? Is that no longer a voluntary situation, so that's a compulsory thing?
I'm not exactly sure on how those laws work, but if those things do exist, yeah, absolutely. When you have a kid, are you forced to enroll them in some sort of a public school? Like, I'm watching, like, The Wire, and they have, in Baltimore, they hire a guy to be, like, a truant enforcer. He goes to the school, they hire him, and then they give him, like, they're like bounties on these kids that he has to go and, like, kidnap and bring to school. And I was horrified the whole time. I mean, the whole show is horrifying. But I was like, do they really have – I mean, I know it used to be a thing. Is it still a thing?
Yeah, I think it's a state-by-state thing. Like, certain states have more strict laws regarding whether you can homeschool at all or whether the kids need to go to – public schools or a private school that basically is, you know, has the same government interventions anyway.
Right.
But yeah, there's truancy laws. So essentially, if you don't go to school, you're in violation and are compulsory told.
It's framed as child abuse, right? It's framed as we're doing this for the kids.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're withholding education.
Right.
Which can only come from government schools.
Right.
So it's a bit of a hodgepodge, I think, and I believe that homeschooling has been making more and more headway. I will tell you that Washington State, in a recent survey of education standards of more restrictive versus less restrictive, Washington State, where we live, scored very, very high in the restrictiveness. Like it's number 48 or 49 out of 50, something like that. Mm. To where, if you want to homeschool, you got to jump through a bunch of hoops.
I remember. Yeah, back in school, there was never any kind of a truant, like, officer that would come around and try and kidnap kids and bring them to school. But I do remember there being a certain number of allowable tardies or missed school days. And I was never really clear on, I think the punishment for that was you're suspended from school, which is kind of a weird, funny thing. You miss so much school, we're going to make you miss more school? I don't know.
That's kind of the opposite of detention, right? Like, you do something bad and your punishment is more school.
Yeah, but if you do something really bad, then your punishment is no school.
So that's an incentive right there. If you're going to be
right.
bad, go all the way. Maximum
right.
freedom, baby.
That's right. So, yeah, obviously I'm against coercion in all forms, so those things are all horrific.
Yeah, so back to our question of it being a macro thing, like, if school is compulsory, and it is in some states, then the indoctrination is compulsory. Therefore, you can't fault the individuals for the bad actions, like you were saying before, where, you know, can we blame, or does the fact that these people went to school absolve them of their own decision-making capacities? And I think in a lot of ways, it's an open question, because if people are only shown one way ever, and it's forced upon them, then why would they think anything differently?
Yeah, there's a really good article, I forget by the name of the guy, but who argues that the only way we're really going to get an anarchic, liber, you know, capitalist type society is to build an actual society, because a lot of norms, a lot of knowledge is culture norms. And like you're saying, if you indoctrinate them in the state, well, how about if we indoctrinate people into freedom? It's different, obviously.
Yeah, it's not indoctrinating. It's more like let them grow.
But if everybody around you is into freedom, you're more likely to be into freedom, as opposed to if everyone around you is like a statist control freak, you're more likely to believe that, you know, statist control freak is the norm and it's the way to do things. Kind of like how you and I grew up in the state, and we were a typical lefty liberal type control freak. I mean, not necessarily control freak people, but we were like, yeah, the state is how you get things done, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this is interesting. I don't mean to segue us from Fight Club, but this is an interesting conversation, especially because, you know, I've got two young children, and once they're school age, I'm not sure what's going to happen, because we intend to homeschool them, or essentially unschool them, which is where, you know, we just facilitate whatever they express an interest in. Hey, you like horses, you like farms, we're going to go check these things out and learn as much about them as you want, you know? But then it also comes to a point where, you know, when he was pouring lye on his hand, he was trying to teach him a lesson, right? Teach himself a lesson, like get through the pain, get through this difficult initial portion, and you'll achieve this greater state of consciousness.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is a bit of a metaphor for with kids. You want to expose them to things and get them to try things to the point of, if they don't quite like it yet or they're not good at it, you don't let them give up right away. Like, you sort of have to prod them to continue on to get to the point where they actually gain an aptitude for it, so they can really know whether they like something or not, right? And that's a difficult space for me right now as a father, because my three-year-old is in ballet class, and she's gone like 6 or 7 times now, and now she's starting to not participate and not want to go. And I'm struggling with, okay, does she know enough to make that decision that she doesn't want to do this, or does she just need to get through this painful initial learning about it situation to where she'll actually appreciate it once she's, you know, another month in or however long? And it's a very gray area for me.
Interesting, yeah. So what kinds of challenges in parenting, especially when you're trying to follow the NAP?
Yeah, because I don't want to force anything on her, but I also don't want her just to learn that she can just give up on anything and it's okay.
Yeah. Cool. Tough call.
Yeah. I remember being a kid, and my grandfather paid for my brother and I to go bowling every Saturday. And for whatever reason, I was a pussy, and I would cry and, like, not want to do it. You know, and now I look back, I'm like, well, that was stupid, you know? I enjoyed it. I should have just not been a little shit about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough call. You have to use your parental wisdom, because you want what's best for the kid. You don't want him to be just a total quitter.
Yeah, so I think what we're going to do right now is we've taken a step back and just said, all right, if you don't want to go, we won't go. But if you do, we'll facilitate it. And if you want, there's an alternative where this other day we can do something where the parents can be involved, and it's a dance class with music, and give her the option and see if, you know, that's a way to sort of soft pedal it a little bit. But back to Fight Club, man. We got to finish this movie.
We got to fight. Okay, so the next scene is a fairly straightforward scene. They are Project Mayhem members are working as like waiters, like the wait staff at some kind of a police ball or something like that. And they back up to the arson with the smiley face. They interviewed like this police commissioner who said, like, we've figured out who it is and we're going to go after him. So in response to that, they're at this function where they kidnap this guy who was interviewed, like this police investigator, commissioner type guy. They drag him into a bathroom, and they threaten to castrate him if he doesn't call off the investigation. And his justification for this violent act is that the people that make up Project Mayhem are the service class. They're the people that cook the food and clean the whatevers and do the stuff. So you better not piss us off. You better allow us to be violent thugs because we also serve you food.
Or piss in your
food. What is the moral of that?
So maybe
let us be violent thugs or else we're going to pee in your food?
Maybe the authorship should be this screenwriter dude, author guy, Galbraith, and Marx.
Yeah. What is the moral there?
It's a three-way.
Let us do what we want, or else we will attack you. Anyway, so this is also, and then to be fair, the Edward Norton part of the Sahi is kind of standing back, going, "Whoa, let's not actually cut this guy's balls off." But still, this is the scene. Then there's a scene where they're in a fight club, and Edward Norton is feeling left out. He's feeling rejected by Brad Pitt's character, by his other psyche, and he just wants to destroy. He said he wanted to, like, destroy something beautiful. So he's in a fight with Jared Leto's character, and he just beats the crap out of him and smashes his face up really bad. Now, there were rules at the beginning of the fight club where if someone, like, said, you know, I quit, or he taps out or something like that, then the fight is over. It wasn't clear in the scene whether the Leto character had done any of that. It certainly seemed to be, if that was in, like, a UFC fight, the UFC, the referee was stepped in and stopped that fight. Because clearly that fight was over. He was just on top of him, ground and pounding the guy's face into a pulp.
Yeah, I think rule 4 or 5 of Fight Club was someone can tap out, or if they go limp or are no longer defending themselves, the fight is over.
Right, so clearly this is a violation of those rules. Those
well, they also did say that the rules were fluid and were sort of day-to-day determined by Tyler and himself, or essentially himself. Like, okay. The rules were fluid.
He's like a dictator guy, and he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, so like any politician.
Oh, good. Okay, so yeah, he takes it too far and breaks the rules and beats the crap out of Jared Leto. But Jared Leto, like the good little beaten lapdog, still continues to support him and be a part of Project Mayhem. And the next scene is Tyler Durden, the Imaginary. This is a really weird scene because you've got two members of Project Mayhem in the backseat of a car. Then you got Tyler Durden driving, and then you got Edward Norton in the passenger seat talking to Tyler Durden as he's driving. So you can imagine it as them being the same character of him just talking to himself while these two members of Project Mayhem are sitting in the back. But in the movie, Brad Pitt lets go of the wheel of the car as he's driving it, like, you know, on the freeway. Clearly breaking a contract, an understood contract of you're going to do your best, what you can, to get the other passengers of the car to the destination that you've all agreed upon. He just lets go of the wheel, and not only is he endangering, obviously, the other people driving in their cars, who, understandably, there is some expectation of danger, and you need to be on your guard to protect yourself, but you don't expect people to just voluntarily let go of the wheel and try to cause an accident. So Brad Pitt lets go, and he's, like, trying to inspire the Edward Norton character, like, let go of the world. Stop trying to control everything, man. Let go, man. Just let things be. So it's some sort of another teaching moment from Tyler. And so then the car crashes, flips, and everybody magically survives the car crash. And apparently, I don't know if there was a lesson learned or not, or it was just another act of terrorism by Brad Pitt's character. What did you think of this scene, Daniel?
Well, that's a scene I haven't seen in a few years. I hadn't gotten to that point yet in my rewatching of it, as I have to split my watching into 20 or 30-minute segments as to when my family allows me the time to watch it. So I will make an effort to watch it more tonight, and I don't know, maybe mention a few additional things in our next episode of the Reed Rothbard podcast.
Okay, well, based on what I said, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, there's certainly an expectation of awareness of your environment. You're on a highway, accidents happen. But you certainly shouldn't go out of your way to cause those accidents. So I think that's a bit of a violation of the NAP. Accidents will happen even when people aren't trying. I don't know. I don't really have a whole lot to add to it. I mean, is there like an angle you wanted to talk about on that?
No, just that there is an implied contract, I think, when you get into a car with somebody, that they are going to do their best to not kill you. Whereas here's this person. I mean, generally you think of an accident in a car as being nobody's fault, but this is clearly, I think, a violation of the NAP where you are trying to cause an accident.
Well, and we don't know how it would be. We don't know how it would be in a free market for roads, though. We only know the government provided roads. Well, and provided is a loose term. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But who knows? In a free market society, we might be so much further advanced if it wasn't for all this waste and destruction that is caused by
government. Oh, come on. Government only wastes $4 trillion a year. It's not like a big hit.
And who knows what else could be created if people's preferences could be demonstrated with the money that isn't stolen from them. We might have highways and byways that only allow self-driving cars, and accidents are down to nothing.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Like, Walter Block's argument is always, if the government were not involved, some estimates are that GDP and the standard of living for the average person in the United States would be 4 to 5 times greater than they are presently. And this is all, of course, estimates, right? So who knows what bounty would be at the end of that? You know, where would we be had this interventionist state not meddled? And so he even blames natural disasters, hurricanes, droughts, tornadoes on government as an extension of, had the unhampered free market been allowed to proceed, perhaps these things would have been solved in a free market way.
Yeah, and an important notion is to understand that it's a compound. It multiplies. For every year that you don't have this government intervention, and the human innovation builds on itself, it continually builds. So who knows how long ago we would have had the innovations that we have today, and what would new technologies and innovations would have been built on those technologies today.
Right, it's an extension of Moore's law, where processing power doubled every 18 months or whatever it was. And I think, is it Ray Kurzweil? He's the guy who talks about singularity. And basically the increased rate of growth of technological advancement, like essentially like wherever we are and whatever technologies exist today are now the groundwork for future endeavors and additional growth on things that weren't even thought possible recently. Because right. Now the stepping stones have been laid, and so now people can take those as their building blocks for even further expansion in technological progress.
Yeah, it's compound. It multiplies on itself, and it's exponential. And yeah, who knows? It's horrific, but they don't get any of the blame. It's awesome. Okay, so you don't know anything further after that. The last you've seen is probably like the fight with Jared Leto or something like that.
I hadn't even made it to that point yet. I had seen just a happy face in the building, and the Ed Norton character going, "What have you guys done?" And the people looking at him like all confused, because to them, he's the guy who told them to do it.
Okay. Okay, well then let's sally forth here. We don't have a whole lot left. Well, there's quite a bit, but you'll do your best to chime in. After that, the scene with the driving scene, there's a scene where some Project Mayhem members are running away from a mission where their mission was to destroy a piece of corporate art and to destroy a coffee bar. So they get this corporate art of this ball, and they blow it up so that it starts rolling, and it rolls into this coffee bar. And they're all dressed up in like black and ski masks, and they're running away from the scene when a cop shoots at them. And Bob gets killed, played by Meatloaf, Big Tit Bob. And it's the Edward Norton character's line is, "Well, what did you expect? You're dressed up in ski mask and you're running out and destroying property. What did you think would happen?" And then the other project members are saying, "Those sons of bitches, they shot Bob for no reason or whatever, or we'll get them," or something like that. From an NAP standpoint, I'm a little bit torn on this one. Obviously, it's immoral to destroy property. I'm not sure. I mean, it serves the plot for the cop to shoot and kill Bob. I'm not sure what it serves the property owner to shoot and kill the transgressor at that point after it's already happened and they're running away.
Well, you essentially just boiled down the whole problem of the modern justice system, right? There's no real restitution to the actual victims. There's only punishments doled out to the perpetrators.
Right.
And somehow that's justice.
Right. So, yeah, that happened. And then my last couple notes here. There's with the death of Bob, it kind of sets off as a catalyst throughout the movement, I guess you could call it, throughout the cult, because Tyler or Edward Norton is like, "No, this person, you can't just bury him in the garden." They wanted to bury him in the garden. He's like, "No, you can't do that. This is Bob. He has a name. His name is Bob." And the other brainwashed cult members are saying, "No, in Project Mayhem, we have no names. We are not individuals." And then he goes, "No, but we're Bob." And he's, the leader. So then they go, "Oh, I get it. In death, you have a name. In death, after you've served the cult, you get your identity back and your individuality back or something like that. So that was really gross. So terrified at this, Edward Norton goes to a police station to confess his role in these events. And he's being interrogated by a couple of cops, and like the lead cop has to gets called away. And the three cops remaining are all Fight Club members. And they're saying that, well, we really admire you for doing this. This is going to be a great message that anybody who goes against Project Mayhem gets their ball cut off, because that's what you said, and that's how it goes. And Norton goes, ha-ha, it was just a test. You don't actually have to do that. And they're like, you said you would do that. You said you would say that. And no matter what he says, they all say, you said you would say that. You definitely said you would say that. And so they're about to castrate him when Norton pulls one of the guns off of the police officers and escapes. And so he's out. And he goes out and he's running away from the police station, and he runs out into traffic. And just as a commentary aside, in this movie, there's a lot of people running out into traffic. It just happens a lot in this movie for some reason.
The Helena Bonham Carter character, she just walked out into traffic several times, and that made me think that maybe she was a figment of his imagination, because she appeared to walk out in traffic as if the traffic wasn't there.
Or she wasn't there, right. She does it a bunch, and then Norton does it later on. And at first he's like horrified, like, what are you doing running out of traffic? And then he goes and does it a bunch of times. Anyway, it's weird. So then we kind of get to the climax of the movie. Project Mayhem is in full effect, their big grand scheme. And their grand scheme is to bomb a bunch of credit companies and essentially get rid of all the records of any kind of financial transactions, any kind of debt. And in the quote of the movie is that the goal is to have economic equilibrium.
Yeah.
So very anti-capitalist, very commie type of idea that any kind of usury or loans or anything like that is unjustified. That, I don't know. I'm sure you've got things to say on this, Daniel.
Yeah, that seems like very Marxist, like the debt jubilee situation, like let's make everybody equal or reset the system so that everyone starts from zero. But it's the whole egalitarian debate. You know, if you reset everyone to zero, people are still taller than others, shorter than others, smarter than others, more entrepreneurial than others, lazier than others. Like, it won't be long before those who do will do, and they will again create a disequilibrium in the economy, which is not a bad thing, by the way. Like, if there's no incentive to do anything, why would anyone do anything? It goes back to the whole incentive problem with socialism, and you're going to expropriate and basically destroy anyone. Like, imagine if you were a person who run up a bunch of credit card debt doing a bunch of stupid shit, and someone who was very responsible and had like zero credit card debt, and then this thing happens that wipes it all out. Well, the person who's responsible hasn't gained or lost much of anything in reality, but in a relative sense, they're now equal to someone who is a dumb shit in terms of their spending and habits. And it's a penalty.
It's very not personal responsibility. I don't know how to say it, but it's very much, I'm a victim of my circumstance. I am a victim of some oppression, I suppose, and that's why I'm in debt, not because of any other reason, so therefore it's illegitimate. It's this idea of oppressors and oppressed, very Marxist. But keep going to what you're saying.
I mean, even if you reset everything, like, people are just going to revert back to their previous situations for the most part, depending on their habits and their life choices, you know? Like, people will trend back to where they came from unless they have a reason to change, and the change has to come from within. They have to decide for themselves that they're either going to work for something or they're going to work for handouts. And the more that handouts are available, the more attractive that becomes.
Absolutely.
So send all your hate mail to Daniel@ReedRothbard.com or Robert@ReedRothbard.com, because I'm sure we're saying a little bit of more controversial stuff here. But that's kind of our thing, maximum freedom.
Yeah, and I like I said before, I'm watching The Wire now, and it's all the struggle of these government people trying to figure out why there's so many problems and how they're trying to figure it out and whatever. And I keep screaming at the screen, welfare. there's all this incentive for people to lay around and not do anything. And with all this, you know, they have some extra money and they buy drugs and then they get hooked on drugs and whatever. But would they be able to just get stoned all the time if they had to have a job? It's very, Yeah. Anyway, Sowell and I forget the other guy's name.
Williams.
They do a really good job explaining why welfare just destroys people.
Yeah, and maybe you could. I mean, there'd be more jobs available. Like a friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours actually, recently posted on Facebook regarding the new overtime law, and she was basically saying, "Well, my dad always said, if your job or if your business depends on paying people crap wages, then you have no business being in business."
Mm.
Which is just terrible. I wanted to respond to that and say, so you're saying that it's better that that job not even be there at all, and so those people wouldn't even have a job?
Yeah, they don't see that as an argument for unemployment, but they think they're compassionate, but it's actually an argument for unemployment, abject poverty. Sweet.
Yeah, awful.
So to get back to Fight Club or to wrap up on Fight Club, it's a piece of art, and you can interpret it any number of ways, which is fantastic. I mean, when I first saw it, I saw it completely differently than I did recently. But you can make an argument that the Tyler Durden, the insane half of his mind, is doing these horrific things, and that the sane part of his mind, the Edward Norton character, is fighting to stop it, sort of. But at the same time, it's not in my viewing, I didn't necessarily see that the film was trying to portray Pitt as the villain character, kind of, and especially more towards the end. But so you could either look at it as an anti-kind of communistic thing, saying that, no, Norton is trying to stop this from happening, and that Pitt, the villain character, was making it happen. Or you could maybe also, there's an equal case to be made that it was a pro kind of communistic message and saying that, yes, this credit shouldn't exist, and that the current state of economy is as a result of oppressed and oppressive, and it's all illegitimate and blah, blah, blah. It's a complex movie. It's interesting, and I don't know if the actual author intended any of it, any of our reactions or anything like that. It's a very mixed message movie. I think we pretty much talked about everything I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I don't know if we came up with anything like groundbreaking about it, but it is interesting how you can watch something that, like you're saying, it is art. It's open to interpretation, and it depends on the lens through which you view it. And you and I were more left-leaning in the past when we first saw this, more on its entertainment value and maybe some of its anti-consumerism message that is certainly there, and I think that was a big thing when we were growing up. And seeing it now and seeing all these holes and issues with it from a philosophical and moral standpoint and economic standpoint. And so it is interesting to go back and watch films like this. And that's why I think this is a good vehicle for us to use to try to extrapolate upon these ideas, to use something that's in popular culture that people are familiar with but maybe haven't viewed with this type of viewpoint. And I think even ourselves, you know, we're seeing this in a different light, and so maybe that will in some way translate to someone else who's hearing us speak about it. There's a long-winded way of saying, I hope we're doing some good in the world here.
Yeah, hopefully if you're listening to this, you're getting something out of it, and hopefully maybe it'll inspire you to maybe go back and watch Fight Club again and have some new appreciation or new opinions on it. I definitely had a different opinion the second time around, and, well, all the stuff that I've learned in these last few years has really colored my view of pop culture in general.
And you can learn all of these things at Liberty Classroom. Still, Black Friday deals going on. ReadRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom. Check it out. You got until Monday to get the lowest prices of the year. Each day it is increasing a little bit, but still always cheaper over the next couple of days than it is the rest of the year. So ReadRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom. Enter to win a Pebble smartwatch, Pebble Time Steel smartwatch. And if you join at the master level, you'll get a readit4.me 1-year membership valued at $299. And sorry to interject my little commercial there, Robert, in mid-speech for you, but I felt like it was a good opportunity to just – I saw the shot and I took it to reference Top Gun.
You saw an opportunity and you grabbed a hold of it. Good. I appreciate your initiative, sir. That's all I've got really to say on this. It's still a well-made movie. David Fincher is a good director. I don't know if he's really done much any – lately. I know he did Seven, another pretty dang good movie. But yeah, it still holds up. Special effects, not so great. I don't even remember them being particularly good at the time. But as a piece of art, I think it still holds up. As a piece of like social commentary, it means less for me, definitely. It seems to be more of a mixed, muddled message. But like I said, you can interpret it any number of ways, and any good piece of art can be interpreted any number of ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it'll be interesting to look at our next film through our current lens, The Usual Suspects. I remember watching that, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago now, and just being impressed with the storytelling. It's very Christopher Nolan. Like, you sort of unwind it in reverse in a way to where you finally realize at the end, like, all these things were signs along the way. And that's always an interesting thing. And I still get chills when the Kevin Spacey character, he's walking out of the police station with his limp, and then he starts walking normal.
Yeah.
You know, it still gets me. And so it'll be interesting to watch it from our new perspective, our you know, last couple of years, more recent perspective.
Yeah, I hope it's as rich in material as Fight Club was. I don't remember it super well, other than it being like this, like, crime tale of one criminal kind of getting it over on his other criminal buddies. But we'll see. It'll be interesting, hopefully.
Yeah, take good notes on that one.
Yeah.
So that'll be the next episode of the Reed Rothbard podcast. This has been Black Friday Fight Club. We just had Thanksgiving. We had the Thanksgiving special. We've got Black Friday deals still going on. Tom Woods, Liberty Classroom, ReedRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom. And if you're doing any of your Amazon shopping, especially for Cyber Monday, for the holidays and all those things, click on any of the links on our website and buy anything you want, anything to your heart's content, and we will receive a small, and I emphasize the word small, commission as a part of that.
Yeah, definitely. Get out there and do that, and we'd appreciate it.
So thanks again, folks. We do appreciate you. We might have a dozen or more listeners these days, and it is always nice to, I don't know, feel like you're actually talking to someone, I mean, other than just ourselves. I mean, we would have these conversations anyway, don't get me wrong, but we wouldn't be plugging Amazon or Liberty Classroom to each other.
Well,
maybe I would. I don't know. I push things on you all the time, Johnson.
But... Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
I think it'd sound a little different.
Probably a little bit. You might sneak it in a little bit more subtly.
Yeah, there you go. Well, hey, thanks again. I'm going to say goodnight from my end, and Robert, feel free to say goodnight on your end.
Goodnight on my end, guys. Take care, everybody. See you next
time. Peace out, homies.
Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.